By way of introduction, I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy with a continuing interest in pharmacy leadership. The purpose of these conversations with successful people is so we can all benefit from their experiences. I'd like to welcome Susan A. Cantrell. Susan received her undergraduate pharmacy degree from the University of Mississippi and completed an accredited residency at the Medical Center. Susan has held several leadership positions in home care organizations, and at ASHP she served as director for the section of home care practitioners, managing director for Advantage, vice president for resource development, and is currently the director North America of the Drug Information Association. Welcome, Susan. Let's start with you giving us a sense of your new job at DIA.
Well, I've just hit the one-year mark, Sarah, and I joined DIA last summer. It's been a challenge, but it's also an exciting opportunity. DIA is a global organization. My responsibilities focus on North America, U.S. and Canada, but the global exposure and involvement with others outside the U.S. has been very exciting. It's one of the things that attracted me to the position. I have had to do some restructuring within my part of the organization, which has been a little bit challenging, but also it set us up for future success as we address the evolving marketplace that we operate in, as well as our changing customer base. So a lot of challenges, but at the same time, a lot of opportunities and a great deal of excitement. So it's been fun so far.
So what was attractive to this new position? You'd been at ASHP almost 20 years.
I had. It was a really big move for me, and not a move actually that I was looking to make. I wasn't seeking a new opportunity. I loved my work at ASHP and have always enjoyed being part of my own professional community and serving the membership in that way. So I wasn't seeking a new opportunity, but as it often does, it dropped in my lap. And I guess the thing that appealed to me most about it was that it would be a different and new body of knowledge for me, very related to what we do in pharmacy, but at the same time different. I hadn't been involved to a great extent in research in my career, in looking at drug discovery and drug development, which is really what we focus on at DIA. So those things were very attractive to me. The global aspect of the organization as well, I think, was very appealing to me. Our pharmaceutical development has all become global, so you really have to operate in that global marketplace, and that's very interesting to me. And I think just a new challenge and a new opportunity. At ASHP, my work focused very specifically on education and resources development, which is another way to say developing resources, financial resources, to support the organization's membership services. And while I enjoyed that very much, there were other aspects of the organization that I really knew I would enjoy being involved in, but because they weren't part of my core responsibilities, I didn't have that opportunity. So at DIA, in my new position, my role is broader. I'm involved with our work with regulatory agencies, especially in the U.S. and Canada, developing relationships with other organizations with which we collaborate. So it's allowed me to broaden the scope of my responsibility a little bit, and that's been enjoyable as well.
What exactly does DIA do?
DIA is a professional society, global, as I mentioned, made up of about 18,000 members who work in every aspect of discovery, development, and lifecycle management of pharmaceuticals, biotechnology products, as well as other medical products. So we're a membership organization, and our mission is really to support innovation in medical products to help boost health and well-being worldwide. So we focus on providing, much like any professional society, educational resources, networking opportunities, a sense of community, opportunities to showcase best practices, all those things that a professional society does typically for its members. We do that.
You mentioned you needed to make some changes. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, DIA is an organization that's deeply rooted in its history. It's been around for almost 50 years now. And there are ways of doing things that sometimes in the association world, we don't stop to realize that we might need to modernize the way we do things. And with NDIA, we saw some major shifts in our customer base, as well as in the way our members interact with one another, in the way they interact with patients. I think one big thing that has changed for DIA is that the patient has become remarkably much more involved in the whole discovery, development, and approval process for medical products. And we really wanted to embrace that. So we've looked at ways to engage the patients in the organization as well as other stakeholders. You know, we're entering an era where you can't develop a product anymore in a vacuum and think that you bring it to market and assume that there'll be reimbursement to cover it. You really have to look at it throughout the development process and figure out, and not only is it a quality product, is it safe and efficacious, but how will it be paid for? Is it a value-based proposition that you'll be able to make once a product comes to market? So we're looking at a whole new stakeholder community that we've had to engage. And we really needed to look operationally at how we set ourselves up to be able to do that. So some of the changes have been related to that, as well as new technologies. We do a lot of education and training, as well as providing information and knowledge resources for our members. Technology has changed so much in a very positive way, but we also have had to look at do we have internally the resources and the structure to be able to accommodate our ability to embrace those new technologies. So really just a period of modernization. I had the benefit when I joined the organization of having such a great staff of very experienced professionals who came from a number of different backgrounds, but they really knew their jobs and they were eager to take on new responsibilities and also to think about things in a different way. So it's been a journey that we've been making together, but it's been very exciting so far.
And being new in the organization, how did you attempt to build relationships with especially your direct reports?
I think that's one thing I've learned in my career is that probably to a certain extent, because pharmacy is a relatively small community, building relationships and collaborating with your colleagues is key to success. You're not going to be successful without it. And so I hope that over the years I've learned to do that more. I think probably my mechanism for doing that is to really search for commonality between our issues, figure out what things we share in terms of mutual goals and mutual aspirations, and try to build on those, looking at areas where perhaps there is a difference among our goals or interest, and you know, setting those aside when you're building relationships. But I recognize the importance of it, and it's something that I've really worked to do because I think collaboration is so key to success.
How often is a woman found in top executive positions in professional organizations these days?
Well, actually, there's a glimmer of hope there. You know, when we look across the landscape at so many industries, there's really a deficiency of women at the top levels of many organizations. I think in the nonprofit world and in the association world, we're a little bit better off than most industries. From data I've seen, about 45% of all nonprofit organizations are led by women executives, which is much higher when you look at, for example, the Fortune 500 companies. You know, there are 20 Fortune 500 companies that are led by women, 4%. That's a really small number. Of course, in the nonprofit world, as the organizations get larger, the budgets increase, the numbers do drop. But at the same time, there are so many good examples and role models of successful women in the nonprofit world that we can look to for advice and guidance and mentorship. I think that's a positive story.
You've been involved in some initiatives for women. Would you talk a little bit about that?
So unlike in the nonprofit world, when we look at the segment of healthcare businesswomen represented really by DIA, which for a great extent would be women who work in the industry, in clinical research, regulatory affairs, medical affairs type positions, as well as women who work for regulatory agencies, both in the U.S. and throughout the world, women who work in academia, especially in research type positions, that's kind of our core audience. When we look at those, the numbers are significantly less than what we see in the nonprofit world. Women tend to ascend to a certain level in these organizations, but not that many make it to the higher levels, the C-suite type levels. So it's very different. And we at DIA have realized that. We formed an alliance with the Healthcare Businesswomen's Association, and we launched an initiative a few months ago to really look at that from the standpoint of providing women the leadership skills and skills development that they need in order to ascend to these positions. And you know, Sarah, it's been such a learning experience for me. I have to say, at no point in my career have I felt like, fortunately, I've been held back or at a disadvantage at all because I was a woman. It just has not happened to me. I know there are a lot of women who can't say the same, but in my personal experience, it's not something that has challenged me at all. And so this has been a real learning experience for me. One thing that we've learned through this initiative so far is that there are some very real and also soluble issues that we've identified that challenge women to move into these higher level positions. One example, surprisingly, is that women aren't the best networkers in the world. You know, if you look at some men who ascend to leadership positions and to the higher level executive positions, they're able to build their network of people. They're able to latch on to a role model and identify a person who can help them, mentor them, and help them develop the skills that they need, and also, quite frankly, position them with the right people to make those moves. We as women, according to the data that we've uncovered, don't necessarily do a great job at that. So that's one area that we've identified for development. And the other thing is looking at how we position ourselves. Sometimes we're accustomed to being behind the scenes, a support role, if you will, in many areas. And so we don't necessarily think that we need to be out there marketing ourselves. We need to be out there making our value proposition, saying, here's what we have contributed to this organization, and I want to be recognized for those contributions. So that's another area that we've identified to focus on. And then another one, which I think is really interesting, and we're not quite sure how to tackle this, but I think it is a challenge for many women, is that at certain points in their career, women are often, in many households, certainly not all, but looked at as having a dual role. They're the caregiver, the primary caregiver, if they're children in the home or elderly parents, but they're also a breadwinner and a contributor to the household income. And so they have a dual role. And those two roles are very challenging. So it often makes women reluctant to step up to the plate to take on the more difficult assignments. And sometimes those more difficult and challenging assignments are what you get recognized for. So that's a challenge that we don't really know what to do about yet, but it's one that we've identified through this initiative. We have a one-year plan in place for now, but we expect that we'll continue the initiative longer. But so far, we've gotten a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, excitement, and support for it. And we'll be hopefully providing some excellent services to help boost the level of leadership.
That makes a great segue into using your experiences. How have you integrated your life? Because you're a woman who has that dual role.
It's not always easy, is it? And I don't think the challenge is unique to women either. I look in my own personal life, my husband and I, we both have challenging positions, and we always have. And I can say that in my case, that's really been the key to being able to do what I wanted to do and work to advance my career and to have the flexibility to take on new and challenging roles, is because I have such a really good support system at home. and I hope my husband thinks the same. We really have a sharing of responsibility. There have been times that one person's career has had to take precedent over the others in some of the decision-making. Moves, for example, that we've made often have been related more to his job than to mine. But of course now I'm traveling every week and away from home frequently, and so he's had to then take on a very different role, although at the same time he has a challenging job himself. So we've somehow managed to share that responsibility, and for me it's been all about having that support system at home, that sharing of responsibilities, and also that concept of equality between the two of us. It's like, you know, for this 5-year period of time, it might be my career taking the lead role or driving some of the personal decisions that we've made with our family. And in the next 5 years, it might be his. So it's been a real sharing. And I can tell you that I would not have been able to do many of the things that I've done. For example, my role with ASHP, when I relocated to North Carolina a number of years ago because of my husband's job, but I had the flexibility at that time to be able to work part-time or not at all, spend a little bit more time on the golf course if I wanted to, because that was a commitment that we had made together. So what it allowed me to do is take a part-time role with ASHP to create this new division that they were developing, and be able to lead that, which quickly grew into a full-time role, but it gave me the flexibility that I needed in order to do that. So it's been a really good partnership, and that's been the key to being able to have this flexibility.
When your family was young, were there trade-offs you made? Could you discuss some of those for the audience?
Absolutely, and I would say probably travel, you know, is the most challenging, because in an ideal situation, we would want for one of us to be at home all the time, and sometimes that just wasn't possible. And when you have young kids at home and they're in school, they need their parents, they need the support system in place, and so we really had to work at how we managed that and make some trade-offs. And, you know, I could look back now, Sarah, when the kids were small, and give you many examples. I'd prefer not to, if you don't mind, but I could. Many examples of where I was faced with a decision, or my husband was faced with a decision of, I need to do this for work, but I need to do this for home. And probably more often than not, work won out in those decisions. And, you know, being much farther down the path now, I look back on some of those and I think, gosh, I really, given the chance for a redo on that, here's what I probably would have done. But at the same time, when you talk to our kids about it, they don't think they missed out on anything because of that. So they understand it as well. So I think there are so many trade-offs that you have to make, especially when you're, I have a friend who wrote a book about it. He calls it super couple syndrome. And when you have super couple syndrome, two people in very demanding jobs, you always have to make those trade-offs and decisions. And sometimes you might wish that you had an opportunity to rethink those.
Did you, in my term, buy services like maids or nannies or things to help you?
Absolutely, we did. Especially, not so much nannies for a live-in type of arrangement, but when we both traveled, we certainly had to have reliable childcare. And so we were really fortunate to be able to find often the grandmother types, women who had retired from work, but were looking to pick up a little extra money and really enjoyed being around children. And I know when we lived here in the Washington area, we had a woman who stayed in our home to keep the children, and she really enjoyed the kids. And so she would call and ask us to take them to amusement park or a play or what have you. And so really, when you can find someone like that who shares your values for child raising and is interested and motivated, likes to be around kids, maybe even has grandchildren, but they're not close by, then that's a great situation. And that really got us through a lot of the time.
And now that you have grandchildren, does that change any of this? And you're still both active in your careers.
We are. We are. Well, we're fortunate that our kids live nearby, so our grandchildren live nearby. And any opportunity that we can see them, we certainly do. So, yes, it does, because I would imagine as the grandchildren get a little bit older, all those Little League games and soccer games and dance recitals and things as grandparents will want to attend. And so, yeah, I may be faced with some of the same challenges and decisions as I was when our kids were small. It doesn't make it any easier, but, you know, I think the key to that is we talk so much about work-life balance. I prefer to use the term work-life integration, because that's really what it is to me. It is integrating those two parts of your life in a way that feels comfortable to you and your family. And there's no magic formula for it. I think some people might look at my life and my husband's life and think the work part of it is way out of proportion to the personal life, but it feels comfortable to us. And we challenge ourselves to make sure that we spend the amount of quality time that we think we need. We make the best use of the time, the family time that we have together. And so I think it's all about, there's no magic formula for it. There's no percentage that you should try to achieve. I think it's all about what feels right to you and your family. And so that's what we strive for.
Career-wise, where do you see yourself in 10 to 15 years?
Well, that's hard to say, Sarah. I try not to predict because my career pathway has been somewhat unpredictable, to be honest with you. When I look at my expectations of my pharmacy career, when I chose pharmacy as a career, I expected that I would be working in the community pharmacy. I grew up in a small town, and I worked at the pharmacy very young, and I saw myself behind that counter at the corner drugstore. And then once I got into pharmacy and I learned some of the many career opportunities that we have, certainly one of the wonderful things about our profession, my interests changed quite a bit. And I realized hospital pharmacy was my pathway. And somehow in the process, I took a complete turn and I became an association executive. And yes, in a pharmacy association, and now in a healthcare-related association, so still related, but not at all the career path that I set myself out on so many years ago when I was in pharmacy school. So I'm a little bit nervous to predict because, you know, sometimes serendipity plays a role in our career choices as much as we might not like to admit it. So where I see myself in 10 to 15 years, though, I really enjoy the association world. I think there's so many opportunities in associations. I can't get far from healthcare. There's an association for everything, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, but I don't see myself moving out of the healthcare area. But I really do see myself staying in the association or nonprofit world. It gives you so many opportunities, and there's a service component of it in terms of serving your membership and your constituents that I really enjoy. So I'd like to say that in some role within an association is where I'll be and where I expect I'll finish out my career. But that could change.
So drawing on your career experience, what career advice do you have for the young people in our audience?
I think one important thing is, yes, you need to develop a path. You need to set goals for yourself, and you need to have some ideas of where you want to go, but don't close your mind. Don't stay so focused on that you might lose sight of new opportunities that could really be enriching and fulfilling for you. And that's exactly what happened to me. When we moved to the Washington, D.C. area 20 years ago now, it was a job move for my husband, And I had been involved with ASHP in a volunteer type capacity, member of the House of Delegates, very involved at the state level in our state society. And I really enjoyed the volunteerism aspect of association work. So when we made the move to Washington, I was looking at some potential career opportunities. And at the top of my list was, I'd like to work for ASHP. Now, I really didn't care what the job was at the time. I just knew that that was my professional home, and I thought I would really enjoy working for ASHP, whatever the role was. And so I set my sights on an opportunity at ASHP, and I was hired at ASHP for a very different opportunity, but nevertheless one that was well suited for me. And 19 years later, I was still there. It was exciting to me, but had I not opened up my mind to the possibilities that might have existed, had I stayed on that track of this is exactly what I want to do, I might not have entertained that, and I think I probably would have missed out. So stay open-minded and don't hesitate to look at a new opportunity, even if, like I did last year, you've thought, no, I'm not interested, I'm not looking for a job, I like the one I have. Sometimes it's not a bad idea just to look and see what opportunities are out there and explore the unknown a little bit, because you never know what you might find.
Excellent advice. Having worked with you personally over the years, I admire your ability to get things done without getting tied up in laborious processes. I want to draw you out on how you've developed your innovative approach, or being willing to do things differently. And so let's step back now and sort of review your career. How did you initially get into pharmacy? Why pick pharmacy?
Oh gosh, that goes back a long way, Sarah. I, at the age of 14, went to work for a pharmacy. And it was the corner drugstore in my hometown. I can remember it so well. I have two older sisters, and my oldest sister worked as a clerk in the pharmacy part-time while she was in high school. Then she had an opportunity to move to the hospital as switchboard operator in the evening. And so when she left the pharmacy, my middle sister took her job. And then she had an opportunity to do the same thing, move to the local hospital. And so I hopped on my bicycle, rode to the pharmacy and applied for the job and got hired right away. So at the age of 14, I started working for a pharmacy, in a pharmacy, and I really enjoyed it. I got to see the dynamic with the customers. I don't think that I was looking at it so much in the scientific sense, but really as a customer service type role, the interaction with the people and the pharmacist that owned the store that I worked for was a really good role model, well respected in the community. So it was inspiring to me. And I decided at that point, I only wanted to be a pharmacist. And if I hadn't gotten accepted into pharmacy school, I'm not exactly sure what I would have done, but it was all I wanted to do.
So why do a residency?
Well, that quite frankly was a matter of serendipity as well. As I entered pharmacy school again, thinking that I would move into a community pharmacy role when I graduated, I did a rotation in a hospital pharmacy, and it was very eye-opening to me. I realized that was what I was meant to do at the start of my career. Hospital pharmacy was just absolutely the right fit for me, and I enjoyed it so much. And I had the benefit, too, of working in that rotation for a woman director of pharmacy who was very inspiring and, again, a good role model, a good person for me to look at and say, you know, I can model myself after this. She exhibits great leadership qualities, and she's someone I'd like to be like. So that was a great experience for me. And so the plan at that point was to look for a job in a hospital pharmacy. But as luck would have it, I attended, during that rotation, a meeting of the Mississippi Society of Hospital Pharmacists at the time, and along with one of my preceptors. And I met someone who anyone viewing this video will likely have heard of, and that's Bernice Breland. Wonderful leader in the profession, very inspiring person. And he talked to me at that meeting about a residency program that the University of Mississippi Medical Center, where he was currently located, was developing. New program, just starting it up, looking to recruit their first resident. And it, as bizarre as it seems right now at this point in my career, I didn't even know that residency training existed for pharmacy back then in 1983. So that was a whole new learning curve for me. And so the next week I visited the hospital. I talked to him and the director of pharmacy there, Jimmy Heyman, about the residency program. I toured the hospital and I realized, this is what I should be doing. And so I applied for the residency program and started that summer. And I was the first resident accepted into the program.
Tell us about your first pharmacist job after you finished the residency.
I had the benefit of being hired at the medical center as soon as I finished the residency program. And our model there for the management team was director, associate director, and a supervisory staff of five people. They were creating a new position at the supervisory level to implement a pharmacy-based centralized IV admixture program in the adult hospital. And I had spent the year in the residency program really being trained for a management role. While it was a general residency, PGY1 now it would be called, there was a real focus on administration and management. And so, it was kind of what I'd learned over the last year. So I did apply for the job. Did not know if I would be successful or not, but I thought it was worthwhile, and I was hired into the position. And now that I look back on it, I think, that was a big job for somebody so young and right out of residency. I know it's not so uncommon anymore, but at the time it really was. But I moved into that role, supervisor of sterile products, it was called. But my goal for the first 6 months there was really to implement a pharmacy-based IV admixture program, which included a build-out of the pharmacy IV admixture area and, training of the nursing staff. And so it was a big job, but it was a great fit. I had really been trained and groomed and mentored to move into a role like that. So it was a great fit for me and very exciting.
Were there learnings that have benefited you the rest of your career from that first position?
Oh, absolutely. I can't even tell you how many. One thing was your first management role. If you think back on your first management role, how many things did you learn in your first 2 or 3 years that have really been foundations mm-hmm. for so many management decisions you've made in your career? For me, I guess one significant thing was that I had spent a year in my residency program working as a very junior member of the department and learning from some of the very people that I would then be supervising in this new role. And that can be a little bit challenging for you as well as I think for those people, because yesterday you were their student and next week you're their supervisor. You're their manager. So that was a little bit of a lesson for me, is how do you ascend from one level to the other and develop the credibility that you need in order to work effectively with your staff. You asked me earlier about how do you develop relationships, and I think probably that experience for me was the foundation of being able to develop relationships with staff and work closely with them. And you really have to have credibility as a manager. And so that was somewhat of an uphill battle in my first job, only because of where I came from. So that was a powerful learning experience. But I think the other thing was the challenge of the job that I had to do, which was implementation of this IV admixture program in a 500 plus bed hospital. And so many aspects of that I knew nothing about. I really wasn't an expert on IV compounding or aseptic technique, or certainly not on engineering an IV admixture room, purchasing equipment. All those things were new to me. So what that job, it's a little bit of trial by fire. What that job made me do was figure out a plan for getting these things done when you're charting unfamiliar territory. And I've had to do that so many times over and over in my career now that I think that probably was a really good foundation for it. So I can't tell you how many things I learned. I think one other thing that I would say is important is in my first few years in a management role, developing a network of people that I could learn from. And it sounds selfish, and it is, but we should be that way. You know, that's one of the reasons that professional associations exist, is because they create an environment where people can come together and learn from one another and share their best practices. And so I spent a lot of time early in my career looking at the Sarah Whites of the world and learning from what they had done, reading the journal, meeting people at meetings and things like that. So all those lessons have carried through with me throughout my career.
A couple of times you've mentioned mentors. Why don't you talk a little bit about the value and what mentorship is?
Well, I think the real value of it is being able to look at a role model and learn from them, learn decision-making, learn professionalism, learn from executive presence, model your behavior to a certain extent after others who have been successful in similar roles. And I think it's very important. So you and I are working together on a project, Sarah, that we will hopefully move forward on. And it's all about sharing sage advice from people who have been successful in their pharmacy careers with young and emerging pharmacists who are aspiring to do great things in their careers. So how often do we look back and say, I wish I knew then what I know now? And I think one of the things that mentorship does is it gives us the opportunity to maybe not learn by experience, but learn by example. And I know in my own career, it has been so important to me just to talk to people, share experiences, and learn from some of the challenges that they've had. It's really been valuable to me.
Why don't you explain a little bit about the project that we're working on?
Certainly. So we're embarking on the development of a book that will be a compilation of letters from individuals who have been successful in their careers in pharmacy in a number of different practice settings. And what we'll be asking them to do is write a letter to a hypothetical young pharmacist and share with them their perspectives on things they've learned throughout their career that they really could have benefited from knowing early in their career. That's what it's all about. So an experience that happened, you know, school of hard knocks, unfortunately, in some situations for some people, if they lost a job, how did they recover from it? And, you know, those types of experiences that you might not understand the full depth of the experience and what it can mean to your overall career until you go through it. So hopefully by sharing some of those experiences, both good and bad, with young pharmacists, we might be able to better help them prepare themselves for what lies ahead in their career.
How did you come up with this idea? Because it's quite innovative.
Well, we talked a little bit about the women's initiative that I'm involved in, and it was really related to that. There are a series of books from women leaders that are based on letters written to their own younger selves as well as younger women. And I look at pharmacy and I think, gosh, we have such a wealth of information, much like what you're doing with these conversations, sharing and imparting wisdom from people who have had long careers in pharmacy. And so it's a similar type approach to that. But it just popped into my head as I was thinking about, I have worked throughout my career with a lot of students. And at ASHP, I was a preceptor for students rotating in advanced pharmacy practice experience rotations through the organization, and you think in a 1 month rotation, what can I share with this person that will really be meaningful for them in 5 years? And so those types of ideas about sharing and imparting the soft skills, the things that you're not going to learn in pharmacy school, that you will learn to a certain extent in residency training, but not completely, dealing with difficult situations and things like that. So it just occurred to me that this letter format might be a really good way to share some of those experiences with younger pharmacists that would help them along the way.
And so the publisher will be?
ASHP will be the publisher of it. We've submitted a proposal, and it looks like we'll be moving forward soon. And I'm excited about it.
Excellent. Let's step back into your career. And you were at the medical center, and after 4 years, you went to work for Southern Health Resources. Why don't you tell us what that is and what jobs you had there?
Okay. Southern Health Resources at the time was a pediatric specialty home care company. And that was my first step into the world of home infusion therapy. And it was at a time when that whole industry was really relatively young and emerging. And so it was a really exciting time to be involved in it. I took the role of pharmacy manager at a new facility that the company was opening. And so it was a startup job in a number of ways. While we had corporate support, it was a new facility, had to hire some staff and, you know, develop processes and procedures and things like that. It was also a time in the industry where, in the home infusion industry, where we had to make our case for why certain therapies, high-tech type therapies that traditionally had been delivered only in the hospital setting, could be done safely, more efficiently, and in a more patient-friendly manner in the home setting. So it was really an exciting time to be in home care. A real challenge for me to leave because hospital pharmacy was my career pathway. I wanted to be a director of pharmacy in a hospital. And so I had to do a lot of soul searching when I was presented with that opportunity. But I decided to give it a try, and it was a very positive experience for me.
So then you moved on to ASHP. What influenced your decision?
So the move to ASHP was a geographic move in some ways. We were relocating to the Washington, D.C. area. I had been involved with ASHP in a volunteer capacity, and ASHP was my professional organizational home. So I had a significant attraction to the organization, and I had enjoyed my volunteer work, and I thought, well, I see other pharmacists working there. They're making a career out of this, so maybe I could do it as well.
So the position you came into ASHP as, talk a little bit about that.
I was hired by ASHP with the title of Director of Home Care and Managed Care, which in 1992 were two still emerging areas. Home care, I've mentioned, managed care as well. ASHP was getting more familiar with the payer community. Managed care was becoming much more important in pharmacy benefit management. And so it was a really important emerging area for the organization as well as the profession and healthcare in general. And so I had the dual role of home care and managed care initially when I was hired at ASHP. I shortly thereafter had a change in my role as the ASHP Board of Directors made a decision to create the first membership component group, which at the time was the ASHP section of home care practitioners. I became the staff director of that section.
You mentioned component groups. Talk about what those are and their value.
Well, component groups within ASHP and the home care section was the first, existed really and still do for the purpose of focusing society resources and attention on a particular area of practice. So for the ASHP section of home care practitioners at the time, what we found was we had an increasing number of members, and most of those members had been in hospital practice, and they moved from hospital practice into the home infusion therapy setting. And they had a unique set of needs, quite frankly. It was the time when the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, actually back then it was HCFA, Healthcare Financing Administration, was struggling with how to pay for or provide coverage for home infusion services. So there was a part of the advocacy platform that really needed the input of those members. They had some unique educational needs, because all of these therapies that we were providing in the home setting, for the most part, had traditionally been done just in the hospital setting. So how do you do that in the home? What kind of equipment do you need? How do you train the caregivers? All of these things that we as pharmacists needed to learn. ASHP obviously was the logical place as our association home to provide that education, but we needed a forum to help develop that, and we needed those thought leaders to assist in that process. So we really had the segment of the membership had a unique set of needs, and the organization recognized that. ASHP said, we really need to focus in on how we're going to meet the needs of these members, and the current structure isn't necessarily set up to do that. So the idea of creating a section of the membership grew out of that. And the home care section was created, became very successful fairly quickly, generated a lot of excitement among the members because their needs were being met. We had even had a dedicated home care meeting, interdisciplinary meeting, back in 1994. And the second section was the section of clinical specialists, now section of clinical specialists and scientists. And that was the second group, and it basically replaced the old specialty practice group model that had been in place and created an organizational home for those specialists. And of course now the model has evolved, and you have other sections within the organization. But I think it was really a step in the right direction for ASHP in looking at member segments that had unique needs and developing an organizational strategy for how those needs would be met.
Next, you took on the managing director role for ASHP's Advantage. Talk about what is Advantage.
Well, that was a very exciting time in my career, and it was a lot of fun, to be honest with you, to be involved in the early days and throughout the existence of ASHP Advantage over the last several years. In the early 1990s, ASHP was looking at its traditional sources of revenue and some changes that were taking place in the marketplace, and our CEO at the time, Dr. Otis, appointed a staff committee to look at new business opportunities for the association to generate non-dues revenue. And as with any association, non-dues revenue is key to being able to provide your membership services. You can't charge the members enough to pay for all the services that they need, so you have to look at alternative sources of revenue. And I was part of that staff committee, junior member of the committee. But out of that grew the concept of ASHP Advantage, and what that was, Sarah, is essentially a medical education unit within the organization that developed educational and informational resources for the members, and it did so with funding from the industry, pharmaceutical industry, as well as other related companies, educational grant funding.
My experience is that it had a unique culture, separate really from ASHP per se. How did you, as the first director, really create a unique culture?
Well, probably a part of that culture came out of the way the organization developed. I remember so well having that conversation with Mary Jo Riley, our chief operating officer, who was in charge of developing that business unit. And she asked me, in my geographic move down to North Carolina, if I would be interested in working with ASHP to help get it started. And there were low expectations, to be honest with you. We recognized that this was not a business that ASHP had been in before. The organization did a fabulous job at developing educational programs, but the whole grant funding piece and just the model for what we were doing didn't exist within the organization. So we knew there was a certain amount of risk involved to ASHP, and it was somewhat speculative at the time. And so our model was to go out, see if we could generate some opportunities, and then figure out a way to take care of those opportunities, to implement the projects and programs after we had secured the opportunities. And so that led to part of it. Rather than hiring a lot of staff and building an infrastructure, we set out to try to build our success and then backfill with the infrastructure. So we really looked to add staff on a contractual basis to help support the work that we were trying to do as the work came up. And I think that was part of it. We weren't confined by any particular geographic area, so we developed this network of consultants. And then a few years into it, when we realized we're really on to something here, we do a good job, we think this can be successful, we started adding full-time staff. But at that point, we had already created this teleworking type mentality. And this is in the mid-1990s when the word teleworking wasn't tossed around daily. So it was a relatively new mindset. So that was one part of it. And I think the other part of it was we developed a culture of quality and innovation. We wanted everything that we did to be unique and different, educational opportunities that people might not be able to get elsewhere, but also of the highest quality, so that people knew what our standard was. When they participated in a program that we had provided, they knew that they were going to hear a world-class speaker. They knew that they were going to receive cutting-edge information, and they knew that they were going to have a very positive customer service experience. So I can't say that it was anything that I necessarily was conscious about. It just developed over time. I think a lot of it was the people that we had involved as well. Right out of the starting gate, we were able to get some really quality people that have this commitment to doing great work. And when you look at that group now, you see that's exactly the people that are there. They're people who have very high standards. They know how to innovate. They're enthusiastic about what they do, and they are bought into a very high degree of customer service.
Prior to your current position, you were the ASHP Vice President for Resource Development. What was that about?
Well, that was building on the work that we had done with ASHP Advantage, looking again at opportunities to generate revenue to support the society's membership services. And so resources development was really intended to be a center of innovation within the organization, looking at new business opportunities, not just confined to one particular area, but really across the board. It was a new position, like almost every position I've held in my career. And it was an executive level position. I was a member of the corporate group, and it had responsibility really for focusing on business opportunities to support the organization's activities.
So far in your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
Achievement is what I'm really driven by. And I think I probably define success in my own way. Success to me is not just attaining a goal or achieving expectations on a performance review, but it really is about a win in my career. And a win might be customer satisfaction. It might be, bottom line, if there's revenue expectation associated with it. But I'm really driven by success. So I think probably when I look back on my career, when I've gotten the most enjoyment is when I've been able to look at something, a program, a position, a grant proposal, or what have you, and really have felt like it's been successful.
drawing on your career, what advice do you have for young pharmacists?
Well, I think, again, don't limit your opportunities. There are so many opportunities, and now in my current position, I see so many examples of pharmacists who work in various positions in the industry and clinical research and regulatory agencies, opportunities that I probably would not have realized existed as I graduated from pharmacy school so long ago. And their careers are fulfilled, they do exciting work. There's so many opportunities in pharmacy. I would say don't underestimate those opportunities and stay open-minded. But I think probably, Sarah, one thing I've learned in pharmacy that I would tell and have told every student that I've encountered is pharmacy is a really small world. And you just never know at some point in your career when your paths are going to cross with someone for the second time. And so building those relationships in pharmacy is really important. But equally important is not burning any bridges. So really be careful what you do. Try to live up to your commitments, maintain your integrity, and develop those relationships. Don't turn your back on anyone. And you just never know who might be sitting across the table from you at the job interview or whatever the role is. Really pay attention to that. And I think this is my association executive mindset speaking here, but the power of professional community is really important, I think, in pharmacy as well as in other roles. And so we should give back as well through our work with professional associations. So as you move through your career, once you are attaining the goals that you set out for yourselves, remember that there's an opportunity for you to give back to those young pharmacists. And so do that through professional involvement in an association, through participation as a preceptor. There's so many opportunities, but really look for opportunities to give back.
I know you're working on a graduate degree. Do you want to comment to the younger people about if you had your career to do over again, what you would do with regard to that?
I would do it a lot sooner. I would do it a lot sooner. And, you know, I think that's another bit of good advice that I would share with students and young professionals. We're in a competitive job market now in pharmacy, and yes, there are wonderful opportunities, but to get those opportunities you want, sometimes you have to have credentials or degrees that set yourselves apart from others. We have finally unified our entry-level degree, and so you really have to look for new opportunities to set yourself apart. And look at what you think you need in order to do that, and don't wait three decades into your career if you can avoid it. However, if that's your time frame, don't hesitate to do it. Because I guess I think one thing I thought when I decided to go back to school after all these years is that not only did I have a new interest area in public health and that I really wanted to build on and advance my credentials, but I also wanted to debunk the myth that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So we'll see about that. I'll let you know how it works out. But don't hesitate to do it. But the earlier you do it, the better, for so many reasons.
Excellent advice, Susan. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sarah.